somebody on the Savvy Sabs Savvy show apparently thinks that me suggesting that it wasn't a good idea for Nina to come to a Julian Assange telethon in the middle of her election cycle campaign, that that is the reason that Nina lost.
I wouldn't even bring it up.
I'm just so powerful.
Yeah. War on small business. And that is the war that we really face, because I am a small business owner. You've done small business yourself.
I try. I'm not very successful at it. So maybe this will help. I make things like this, but then they sit here as all of these things, but it's inventory that doesn't get sold. So yeah, my small business is here. We're in it. But I would.
This is the beautiful book, The War on Small Business, How the Government Used the Pandemic to Crush the Backbone of America by Carol Roth. She has some really interesting approval testimonials. One that we are a big fan of, Andrew Grohl, who is an amazing chef in Los Angeles. One that we disagree with vehemently most of the time, Ben Shapiro. And then, of course, you do have Neil Cavuto, who I would say is probably the best person on Fox Business if you have to pick somebody. But yeah, you know, the bottom line is I've read it, most of it. It's a great book, and I highly recommend it, even if it isn't completely aligned with where you stand ideologically. But I think we're going to have a great conversation here, because this, to me, is one of the most important issues that we face right now. The pandemic, as we know, has been handled terribly in a multitude of different ways, but no more so than many examples as we've seen. This is a pandemic that has benefited corporate special interests at the highest level, and it has decimated small businesses at the working level, and I happen to be a victim of such. So this is going to be a fun topic to talk about. So without further ado, we welcome to Generational Change, Carol Roth.
Hey, guys. So great to be with you. And I have to be like the total like den mother here and say, Jen, you can't take on inventory. You need to sell first. So create a prototype, sell first, and then fulfill the orders afterwards once you get the cash in. Okay?
But it's art. It's sort of like it comes to me when it comes to me, and I make it.
Make one.
Right, I only do. I only have one of everything. I had an art.
I sell one at a time.
Okay. I'm an Etsy store. So everything is one of a kind. So there is no way to make more than one.
Apparently my mic is way quieter. So let's just pull this thing right into the middle. Let's bring it into
this one.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so this is going to be the easiest way for us to do this evening. We have had, listen, we'd love to be working in a studio where, you know, it's got $100,000 in it and every technological advantage you can imagine, but we're not that big yet. We're getting there.
However,
yeah, become a Patreon, get a Lulu sticker, get a t-shirt like the one that Jen's wearing. I happen to be dressed in professional attire this
evening. He's having a professional discussion.
Well, absolutely I am. So. This is very important to me. So I wanted to impress Carol. So there you go.
Then you put devil horns on me.
And I wish I would have gotten the memo. I would have dressed up a little bit more. But it's a little late in my day, so I figured I'd be casual.
You're somewhere between he and I. Like,
that's right. That's right.
These are Frida horns. See, they've got devil horns, but black flowers, because I love Frida. So, I think of them like Day of the Dead.
Love it.
You happen to have a personal connection with Carol, or you know, from the same area I think you had mentioned?
Where?
I thought you mentioned something about like...
I don't think so. Where are you from?
I'm from Chicago.
Oh, this is what it was. This is what it was. I know people who graduated from your high school probably around your year.
Interesting. Where'd you go to school?
I'm from down here, but my friend from grad school, because I went to Northwestern for grad school, and my friend there went to Deerfield High, and she's a little bit older, but her younger brother is Ted Bonar. Do you know Ted Bonar?
I know the name for sure.
Do you know O.J. Watley? Do you know the Watleys?
The names are from, I think they're a little bit older than I am, but
Yeah, but that was it. It was the Deerfield High thing. And I'm like, no, I've not been there. I've been by there, but... No.
Just by the way, for anyone who's watching this and doesn't know what we're doing, I heard you talked about the being Jewish before, and I'm Jewish. This is what's called Jewish geography. So all of us know it like somebody in common. It's just sort of how it works.
But what is it? Do you think it's... Like, we say that everybody is 6 degrees of separation, but I always say with Jews, it's 2 at most.
Yeah. Most, at the most, for sure.
At most, especially if it's East Coast Jews. Like, then it's like... we're almost like we're one step from Amish.
just like them.
All right. So I think that, and obviously the most important topic in your book, of course, talks about the central versus decentral planning of businesses. That is the order of the day. I think it also speaks a lot to what goes on in regards to the COVID response. Obviously, being in South Florida, as you know, this is a very densely populated area. Most of the Democratic areas of the country tend to be very central planned. The very Republican areas of the country tend to be very decentrally planned. I think that there is a happy medium here that we need to find, because promoting local small businesses is one of the hallmarks that we have been doing ever since the beginning of when Jen ran for Congress, and we've been doing it ever since. Yeah. I think that promoting local small businesses is immensely important, and it shouldn't be political at all. Unfortunately, it has become a political topic, and I think we have to move as far away from that as we possibly can. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, so if you think about the economy, and I always look at things on sort of a spectrum, and on one side, you have just like, take it right down the middle. 50% before COVID, just about, of the GDP and the jobs were in small businesses. There were 30.2 million of them, accounting for about half the economy. Highly decentralized, highly free market oriented, freedom, choice, transparency, whatnot. The other half of the economy is in the hands of about 10 to 15,000 big businesses. And so you just kind of think about that balance of power and why does it look that way? And I contend that that's because of the cronyism that has enabled the tilting of the playing field. And it's on a lot of levels, and I'm sure we'll talk about them. But when you think about supporting a small business and you think about it not being political, I would argue that being free market is the least political thing out there. It is, I define capitalism or free markets as just freedom, choice, transparency protected by the guardrails of property rights. And so if you want people to make their own decisions and have that decide where the dollars are allocated and how innovations are happening and so on and so forth, that's the philosophy that you support. As you move away from that, you move to a system, and I call it central planning because I don't like to get caught up in the different definitions. I think that's where a lot of this discussion goes awry. I'm more focused on principles than I care about politics or names. So if you want a handful of people to make decisions on behalf of everybody using force, using coercion, using control, and usually opacity, that moves you more towards central planning. And so I think the people who are supporting the concept of small business and not making it political is very well aligned with the concept of the free markets. And I think that's really where we should all want it to be. We don't want the government to be in, you know, cahoots with these big businesses and making regulations that tilt the playing field. But that's what happens every single time. And we've seen it in the financial crisis. We've seen it, you know, obviously in this crisis and like sort of every place in between. And so that's kind of the way that I sort of come to this discussion.
Yeah. And I think it's also important to recognize, I think we're getting an echo on your side, Carol. So just hit the mute button when we're supposed to, when we're talking.
You think that's it?
I think that's what it is. I could be wrong, but we'll see. Yeah, I think that's it.
No.
Carol, can you just mute yourself? I think, okay, that's it. Yeah, that's it. Okay. So I think, you know, again, reading, I think you've definitely identified the problem. There's no question that corporate special interests, we say this all the time, corporate special interests are what dominates our political sphere. That includes the major corporations basically running the government. And by doing so, you see what's happened with these bailout packages. They don't actually benefit working people. They don't benefit small business owners. We've seen the videos. I know exactly the one that you were referencing in the book about the restaurant owner in Los Angeles that was not able to run their operation, yet a major studio was able to do the whole shebang. I think it was a Spielberg production.
The rules don't apply to those people.
And as it turns out, of course, they were greasing the wheels of Governor Newsom all the way. And that's why they're able to do it. So hook, line, and sinker, it doesn't matter what political party you're in. Right. Corporate special interests are going to find a way to get what they want. It's really understanding who's on the side of working class people and who's on the side of corporate special interests. We really hammer that message home. Where I think we differ is, where are the solutions? What are the best solutions? We're not opposed to capitalism, but I do think that the hybrid systems that you see in other parts of the world execute it much better than ours, because, as you allude to in the book, we are so far into crony capitalism at this point, we have to come up with a solution that doesn't just involve saying, all right, the free market's going to solve the problem. What is your rebuttal to that?
Yeah. So first of all, I always call it cronyism, not crony capitalism, because as I said, capitalism, freedom, choice, and transparency, there is no place for the crony interests to be involved in that. I would also say that if you're looking at this problem of cronyism, the reason why the government and these big businesses are in cahoots together is because the government has the power to be able to make those grants and decisions. You're not going to be able to take that away with more government. The more power the government has, the more purview the government has, of course, they're going to want to control and get more power. So that's why it's easier for them to corral 10,000 big businesses that have the lobbying dollars that are able to support their campaigns. And at the end of the day, it's just human nature. Like, if you believe that people are inherently greedy, which, by the way, they are, if you believe that people seek out power, which, by the way, a lot of people do, the best structure to deal with that is small government. And it's not saying that there's no government involved. It's just saying that we want them to do what they're supposed to do, protect the guardrails of property rights and stay out of the way. Because if you go back to every sort of issue that, again, this is like, I'm so excited we're having this conversation, because like you said, we're all identifying the same problems with the Federal Reserve and their, you know, bailing out Wall Street and transferring wealth from Main Street to Wall Street, with these big corporations, with the issues in healthcare, with the issues in education. You know, I will contend that, you know, at scale, and of course we can pick out like a tiny little country like Norway, and we can talk about why Norway is not the United States, but at scale for a country that has 330 million people and is developed, the best way to do that is to have the least amount of government, because if we go to the people who created the problem to try and solve it, we're going to continue to get the same issues. Now, we saw this coming out of the Great Recession financial crisis. John, you might have seen this in the book, because I talk about the Dodd-Frank regulation. This is the most frustrating thing ever, and I think we're all probably very much in agreement here. Banks took on too much risk. They basically tanked the economy, not just here in the United States, but on a worldwide basis. It had implications for all of us. And they were told that they were too big to fail. And they got taxpayer dollars to bail them out. And so what was their punishment? Oh, we're going to give you regulation. We're going to regulate you more. The government's going to come in. We're going to regulate you. We're going to give you Dodd-Frank. Well, what did Dodd-Frank do? It killed the formation of community banks. It killed the formation of small business banks. There were a bunch of them that went out of business. So small business lending fell off a cliff. At the same time, then the big businesses or the big banks didn't have as many competitors. They were able to get, at the same time, you know, more free money from the Fed that they pumped into the market. And at the end of the day, they ended up with free rein. So what was meant to rein in the big banks now gave them free rein. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that happen when you say, okay, well, we see that there's a problem. We're going to let the government solve the problem because of this like three-headed monster of big business, big government, and special interests. It never works out. We have no examples in history where it's ever worked out for the little guy.
Right.
Yeah. And yeah, I think that one of the more important things that we obviously want to talk about, as you just alluded to, is we do support the con. Yeah, there's definitely a pandemic back there.
I don't know why.
Yeah, I'm trying to work on that right now. Yeah, Carol, if you could just hit mute again. Yeah, that works. So one of the things that I think is very important to talk about, because I did note it, you didn't talk about it a lot in the book, but you did mention modern monetary theory. And obviously you have your thoughts on that. We do support that concept. I think that there is something to be said for the ability to print money, because we are a currency issuer. We're one of, I think, like a dozen, 13 countries in the world that do it. It's also one of the reasons why, you know, we have a currency that other nations use and we're able to control their markets. That's a whole other layer to, we don't have to get into here. But the point is, if you do have the ability to print money, and the goal is obviously to control inflation, and if so much of our money is wasted, why not be investing it in areas that would make a lot of sense? See, not everybody is obviously capable of being an entrepreneur, being a small business owner. Maybe for some people, having a federal jobs guarantee does make a lot of sense. And having the ability, especially to work on our infrastructure, which is so devastatingly bad, compare it to any of the other major countries in the world, especially China, we are very far behind. And if we're ever going to compete, having the ability to have the government work on behalf of working people, I think would be important. Obviously, making sure that it's executed correctly is very important. But certainly from the perspective of having a jobs guarantee, especially under circumstance, I think does make sense. How do you feel about that? And would you be agreeable that it would be something that would have to be based on maybe a specific time period, a specific goal in mind? How would you see it?
So let me ask you this, like, what is it that you think the government does well?
That's a good question. The government really doesn't do much well, but there's a big difference. For example, you know, one of the arguments that gets made constantly is, and I would say probably one of the more prominent problems that we do have above everything else is, of course, healthcare. And so when the argument for Medicare for All gets brought up and you speak about it with somebody who, let's say, is on the political right, their attitude is, well, I don't want the government running my healthcare. Well, that's not what Medicare for All is. Medicare for All is government-funded healthcare. We already have it. It's Medicare. The difference is we would now expand it and give it to everybody. I don't want anybody controlling what my doctor is capable of making if the free market dictates that they're the best option that's out there. If you're a great doctor and you have the ability to make $500,000, $1 million a year because you can have a backlog of 3 months deep because every person in, let's say, Broward and Palm Beach County think you're the greatest doctor in Boca Raton, I don't care. Let them make that money. That's their business. What I don't need are for-profit middlemen, the cronyism of capitalism that do not bring any value whatsoever to the table, siphoning one-third of the money we put into healthcare into their pockets. If we cut that out, think about the financial freedom and opportunity that small businesses would have by having Medicare for All. We don't want the healthcare that's in Cuba. We don't need socialized medicine in the sense that the government runs everything. What we need is a system where people are able to basically have what they have now without having the for-profit middlemen that are screwing us over. So that, in a way, I think relates to the government funding an operation, not running an operation. That's the distinction that I think we try to be very clear on. And that's kind of where we get bogged down in the minutiae of, well, you just want the government to do this and that. No, we really don't. But we also recognize where the government's value really needs to be made.
Yeah, and I think that this is where good intentions and good outcomes completely split. And I think the intention of having everybody have healthcare that is more affordable and certainly better than the current messed up system that we can all agree is just a complete cluster, right? I think that's where we all can agree. Coming out of the last 18 months and thinking that the government's actions in terms of picking winners and losers, the flip-flopping on healthcare, the flip-flopping on mask stance, the flip-flopping on the Trump vaccine bad, the Biden vaccine good, all of these things. And then the funding, the way that they allocate funding. I mean, we saw it in terms of what went to small businesses versus what went to the big guys in terms of the CARES Act, what was called relief. I mean, the fact that we think that the government, even if you believe that they won't get into running it, could then allocate it, or that this wouldn't become politicized, and that our healthcare, you know, the funding for our healthcare could potentially get caught up in a giant partisan debate. Again, I think it's just it's a nice good intention, but I don't think that the outcome is realistic. Where I think what we could have, I think the problems that we have in healthcare is caused by the government interference in the market. We have nothing that looks like a free market in Maine healthcare. You have a couple of big guys who, you know, supply the big companies. You have a couple, or one guy that like supplies the government that takes up most of the healthcare. And then you have this kind of weird exchange system in the middle. You have all these rules and regulations that actually prevent sort of free exchange. And the areas in healthcare where there is something that looks more like the free markets, things like elective surgery, we've actually seen much more innovation. We've seen the prices going down. So if we moved everybody from the government and the business, as well as kind of, you know, all of us who don't want to be beholden, because it's just stupid. We all agree it's stupid that our, you know, our, we should be beholden to jobs to get healthcare. If we all moved into a free market system where we actually had free choice, like we do to insure anything else in our lives or to purchase anything else in our lives, that would have all of the good hallmarks of competition, which lowers prices, innovation, and not running it through the government. So I think where we kind of, again, I think we're all hitting around the edges of the same things, but in terms of the intentions versus the likely outcomes based on all of the data and our knowledge of sort of the diseconomies of scale in government itself to execute things appropriately. I mean, it would the system that you're talking about would require having the best, most competent people in government at all times to get it done. And I would just contend that a system for governance does not work well when the requirement is to have the best people, and certainly not the way that we elect people, right? On a popularity contest, it's not like we go through and we find experts and people who really know what it is that they're talking about. So you just look, whether regardless of what side of the aisles you're on and who you don't like in Congress, just think about those people. Do you really want those people in charge, even if it's just funding healthcare and deciding what things are important? I just feel like there's a better way. But I feel like it's a little off track to our main discussion.
No, I understand that. The reason I don't think it's off track is for this one reason, because I am a small business owner and I do think that healthcare is one of the biggest expenses that small businesses have to deal with. You know, being responsible for the financial burden of your workers is a very big part of the problem.
And it also makes you anti-competitive with big businesses, because they're obviously able to go in and negotiate these better packages with a handful of companies that they can go in with one company, and that becomes a barrier for you to finding better employees. So I agree that getting that out of the way would be certainly a better option and would make things a more even playing field.
Okay, so then let me ask you this. Let's say we were to come to the negotiating table and we were to say, all right, we want to make sure that everybody in this country has healthcare, and we don't need for-profit middlemen getting in the way of doctors and, you know, nurses. And you mentioned electives, which is fine. I don't think that everything, I agree with you. I don't think everything needs to be covered. I think the basics need to be covered. I think most people would agree with that. The ability to have a primary care doctor, the ability to go to the hospital in case there's an emergency. You know, if people want to get, you know, different types of elective surgeries and things like that, I think you should have, you know, a free market option if that's what you choose to do. I think that being able to have basically flip the system we have now, which is basically have a public system with a private option rather than basically a private system with it's not even a public option if you really want to look at it that way. But I do think if we did have a basic system, a government-funded system, a single-payer system, which is what the overwhelming majority of the rest of the world has, but you were able to have a free market option if you wanted to get even more quality care, I would have no problem with that. And I would think most people would come to the negotiating table. And why? Because you wouldn't have to buy into a private option. You can choose to buy in. That's an economic freedom. But considering, you know, the fact that we're the only country in the world that has medical bankruptcy as an example, you know, these are the types of things that I really do believe we can find the common ground on. Like I said, I don't want the government running healthcare. That's not what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to be able to take our tax dollars and work on our behalf. Now, I know you'd make the example of, well, when do they ever do that correctly?
Right. I think that's the fundamental principle that you just really have to kind of get your head wrapped around. Like, a handful of people are never going to work on your behalf. That is just against human nature. The reality is you're going to do a better job advocating for yourself. So where I would be okay, so if we're at the negotiating table, is saying, well, why don't we have a system where, you know, we fund, like, or the government says you need to, instead of like paying into Medicare, you can pay into your own HSA type of account. And again, we kind of bring everybody into the free market so that you have the competition. Because one of the things you don't have when you have a single payer system is you don't have any competition. And I don't know anywhere that exists where having a lack of competition breeds innovation, brings down prices, and creates more accessibility. So I think that we want to make sure, like you said, that we don't have this insane system with opacity and with ridiculous costs. But the reason, again, we have that is because it's not capitalism. It's not a free market. We don't have the ability to go and freely exchange. We have a handful of options which are tied to these big anchor entities that are filled with cronyism, not a true free market. And again, this isn't, healthcare isn't my sort of 100% area of expertise, but I would say Ovik Roy of FreeOp wrote some really great, he studied sort of all the different systems, and he's written some really good literature that kind of compares the benefits, because obviously you want it to be cheap, as cheap as possible, without sacrificing quality, without sacrificing accessibility, and you can't always get all of those things at the same time. So I think in terms of, again, the government purview and giving more power to them to control these things is a bit worrisome. Like, I think about Social Security, for example, is a great example. Like, you talk about you don't want the middleman, but the government becomes the middleman. And that's not a good scenario either. We want to, again, decentralize these things. So for Social Security, if we all agree a social safety net's a good thing, well, instead of me paying in and having the government get that money and then paying it out the door, why couldn't we have a provident fund where they say, okay, you pay in, but you own that money. And maybe the employer contribution goes to fund people who aren't working. And then you actually have the ability to invest it in something instead of it being out, going out the door and being spent on something else. It takes that power away from the government, but it still gets the same objective going. So I feel like that's where we can still solve these problems, but shrink that power and purview of the people who keep telling us that they have our best intentions at heart, but we know human nature, that's just not the case.
And I do know what you're referring to. I know that this is Rand Paul's idea. I don't think it's that far off. I do think that there is some merit to the idea of it. It's kind of like having like a 401k like healthcare fund, I guess is what you would call it. I think it just really comes down to, like I said, you know, we had a very interesting debate on our show not too long ago on the merits of UBI versus a federal jobs guarantee. And it's amazing how people go back and forth on one idea here, the other idea here. They don't see the importance of actually having multiple ideas on the table. You know, they're very dogmatic, if you will, in what they believe and thinking that, okay, well, this is, we have the right answer. That side doesn't know what they're talking about. And the way I see it, you have to be able to incorporate all different aspects of a system that can obviously get better. One of the things that we talk about a lot on our show is the fact that progressives and libertarians, while they do have significant differences, there's also a lot of significant things that they agree on. And being able to come to the table like we're trying to do,
yeah,
is how we're going to get where we need to go.
No, completely. I completely agree. I think that's been one of the most eye-opening things about writing The War on Small Business and having these discussions is that there really is not that much land sort of, you know, in between where we are, that we're all trying to address the same issues. We're just coming at it from a different background. And I think that the important sort of differential that I see is having a really deep economic background and kind of being able to follow the trail of intentions versus outcomes, because there are a lot of things that are really good intentions that economically don't produce the outcomes that we're trying to get to. And so if we can all identify what those outcomes are and kind of think strategically, I agree. I think that there's a lot of ground. And I do think that progressives and people who are, you know, libertarian or centrist, or like this whole like swath of the middle that's, you know, considered themselves politically homeless, hat tip to Bridget Phetasy, who always talks about it. I do think there's a really great opportunity for us to come together. And now's the time, because the government's done a really great job in dividing us. Instead of us pointing the fingers at them and holding them accountable. We're pointing the fingers at each other when we're the ones that should be coming up with some better solutions. And we may not come up with all the same solutions, but there are certainly places where I feel like, yeah, I mean, again, small business, I'm pretty sure almost everyone feels like the response and the picking of winners and losers and the telling big businesses that they were essential and small businesses they were non-essential and putting in trillions of dollars into the market where seven tech companies gained $3.4 trillion in value while hundreds of thousands of small businesses were completely screwed over, not because they were too big to fail, not because they had done something wrong, but because the government told them they couldn't open. I mean, they'd subjugated their property rights. So I feel like there are these areas, and those are the places where we have like the closest alignment, which you are kind of the easiest to tackle. We come together, we start doing these small things together, and then you get to know each other, and I feel like there's a lot of opportunity there.
Yeah, and I think that this also, and Jen, if you want to jump in.
I mean, like, I'm so far out of this, only in that, like, to me, we're talking about affordable healthcare, and I just don't think it should be commodified at all. Like, I'm just sitting here in my own place, so I digress. So,
I don't either, but I also do believe that you have to, I keep insisting, as I do all the time, that there is a hunger. There is a hunger when it comes to right-wing populism. People are going to paint it with a broad brush and say that everybody's a racist and everybody's this, that, and the other thing. Mm-hmm. We saw what the gentleman from, I think it was called Kareem Coffey or whatever it was the other day. The guy was on Joe Rogan, and he is as right-wing as it gets. And he basically said, you know, the white supremacy nonsense, get the hell out of our sight because we don't need any of that. And that's what it comes down to. The economic populism this is where we're going to get it right, Carol. This is where we're going to get it right because when the GOP and the Dems are talking about the culture war, they're not actually talking about things that are going to help us financially, because that's what we need to be focusing on. The second that we talk about economics, this is why I have, I disagree with a lot of what Rand Paul has to say, but in terms of the Ron Paul side of libertarian economics, there are a lot of ideas there that are correct. Again, the killer be killed mindset, I do not agree with because it doesn't work for everybody. But when it comes to government waste, when it comes to corporate waste, things of that nature, progressives agree with that 1,000%.
Yep. Agree.
And filth and corruption and everybody. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of things that we agree on.
One of the things, my favorite president, I don't mind saying, is Teddy. And I harp on, because Roosevelt was the only person who truly ever challenged the real people in power.
Right.
You know, he was an accidental president because of McKinley's assassination. They really only put him there as a stand because they didn't want him running New York. But the point is, he ended up president. He may have been the most popular president ever in terms of what he accomplished in the 7 years he was there. He challenged Rockefeller. He challenged Carnegie. You know, he was really willing to do what was necessary. And the one thing that happened during his administration that has not been used, as far as I can tell, since, is the Sherman Antitrust Act. There are so many grounds to break up these monopolies, like Amazon, for example. Amazon does probably more damage, as much as Walmart, to small business America than anybody else. And no one is challenging them. No one is saying, listen, we have it in the law that you're not allowed to be a monopoly. It's not allowed. And yet they are a monopoly. I don't think anybody would doubt that Walmart and Amazon are monopolies in their form of operation, especially in terms of delivery service. There is Amazon and there's nothing else.
They've eaten up a lot of small businesses.
They really have.
That's that's the truth.
And then the other thing that ends up happening, because I know a lot of people on the right they're certainly not pro-union, or they go as far as being anti-union. But one of the things that ends up happening when you monopolize the economy is workers' rights literally go out the window. You don't have any rights. You basically have us and that's it. And when there's no competition, you don't have anywhere to go to make a better living. So this is where we really do have to find a way to meet in the middle. And as far as I'm concerned, the corporations at the top that basically are screwing us over on the daily, this is, to me, breaking up the monopolies, I think, is something that progressives and libertarians could come together on in regards to supporting small business. Do you see that as a potential meeting ground, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot to unpack there.
Sorry, I can go on.
I'll do that.
So, you know, certainly, again, and I think it goes back to the concept of, you know, what is a free market, free choice, transparency. I'm going to keep saying again, with, you know, the guardrails of property rights and what is forced coercion, control, a few people making decisions, concentrated power. And I am certainly in favor if somebody gets too big where they're completely dominating, I have no problem in addressing that. The issue is, and I'm a very principled person, is how specifically are you defining that? And where is the line? And how do we keep that principle? Because a lot of the discussion points that I've been having and asking people the questions to define what it is, there's a lot of, oh, well, I know it when I see it, but I can't really define it. And that doesn't work for law. So I think that if we were to come together on something like that, there'd have to be a really clear definition. It's like, at what point is something really a monopoly and truly a competitive threat? And I also think, you know, we like to talk about our rights and we don't like to talk about our responsibilities at all. And there are a lot of things that you could choose to do outside of Amazon that people don't, because they find value in Amazon. I, you know, with my book, The War on Small Business, I've been pushing people to buy it at bookshop.org. You can still buy it online. They will still ship it. So you don't even have to walk to your local small business bookseller. But people like Amazon. And so there are a lot of people like, well, yeah, I get it. That would be nice, but I still bought it at Amazon. So there's the piece of, hey, you know, Amazon does the beauty pageant and they go running around for corporate headquarters and they get special tax breaks and favors and things like that. That kind of stuff we should shut down because we're not controlling that. The government's controlling that. But the stuff that we have control of, I think we need to take a bit of a more active role in terms of capitalism and understanding our role and our responsibility. We can't just demand, well, we have these rights, and, you know, these big bad companies, whatnot. So I think that's one issue. I also have an issue in terms of unions. And again, it goes back to the consolidation of power. Because in many of the cases, again, it goes back to intentions versus outcomes. The intention, oh, we want, you know, workers to have rights and whatnot, but the intentions end up being outweighed by what's the outcome, and that is that many of these unions get really big. They end up benefiting the people who are, you know, in the little club, and they don't really do a lot for the people that they are, you know, purporting to help. We see that particularly in the teachers' unions. And so again, you know, I feel like, again, you can advocate for yourself better than somebody can advocate for you. And I believe in a merit system. And if there's, let's say, for a teacher, a really good teacher, like, there should be no cap on the pay that they get, and they shouldn't be beholden to somebody else who's flying around on a private jet saying, oh, we can't go back to school because, you know, whatever.
Gee, I wonder, Carol, who you might be talking about.
Yeah, I mean, just this is a hypothetical example, Randy Weingarten.
Well, I will tell you that of all the unions that are out there, and it's the saddest thing because, teachers are the most, along with nurses, are the two most important professions we have. And unfortunately, Randy Weingarten, who's been running the teachers union for, I guess, about 30 years now or something, you know, she is the definition of what's wrong with collective bargaining and what's wrong with unions in general.
We have a lot of knowledge on these issues.
And this goes back to my thoughts again around, you know, how you look at power structures. And I think if you look at the big business and you look at big government, you look at big unions, and you look at what we're talking about, decentralization, like if you love small business and you love the idea of decentralization, or if you're a crypto person and you like the idea of a decentralized currency, like that's the antithesis of giving these big entities more power. And I promise you, just like study human nature from all of history and go back to Milton Friedman, who you may or may not like, but like, where are these angels who are going to organize society for us? Like we don't have Mother Teresa's out there. So like, let's solve the same problems that we're talking about. Let's identify the problems, but like, let's maybe just try a potentially different way, or at least kind of talk through like what might be the benefit of doing it in a more decentralized way. Even something like education, Even if it's government funded, which isn't like the most kind of like, you know, centrist or fiscally conservative thing, if you didn't have the teachers unions in there and you had the dollars following the students, which we're seeing a lot of, and you had more competition and you were empowered as a family to be able to make those choices. And the same thing on the teacher, like with technology, if you were a great teacher and you could broadcast to a million students and make $1 million, like, that would be amazing. Like, great teachers should do that. And everyone should have access to it. It shouldn't be based on your zip code. You shouldn't have to move to get like access to the greatest teachers. So I think bringing in some of those free market tenants actually makes it for a stronger opportunity for education. And it's something I think that's been made very clear over the last 16 to 17 months, where we saw the disparity in what happened in private schools versus public schools, and even the shift to some homeschooling because of these kind of core issues.
And I do think that that's a very good point, because one of the things that, you know, we supported Bernie, and one of the things that we noticed when he ran, in particular in 2016 against Hillary, is that when it came to the unions that were basically run by the rank and file. The rank and file, the workers, made decisions for themselves. What is in the best interest of us? What's going to work for us? Anytime a union had that leverage, they voted for Bernie. Anytime it was a corporate board, not the rank and file, that made a decision in terms of which, you know, candidate they were going to get behind, they got behind Hillary every time. So as far as we can see, we're identifying the same problem because we see it the same way. And that's the thing about, you know, what happened between Reitz Priebus and Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Reitz Priebus told the GOP establishment, look, the people want Trump. I am not giving them Rubio, Kasich, or Cruz. If the people want Donald Trump, then that's what they're going to get. And I'm not going to screw our party for the sake of corporate special interests, because our voters will revolt. On the other side, Debbie did what she had to do to screw Bernie, give it to Hillary, and they still lost. And so that is something that I think we can universally get behind. And as you can imagine, you know, we're of the, you know, we love Nina Turner, we love Andrew Yang, we love Bernie, we love non-corporate approaches to economic solutions. We love the idea of having, you know, more of a camaraderie, even with people that we disagree with. We are dead set against the cronyism of politics. If you knew what we thought about people like Debbie and Dick Durbin and Nancy Pelosi, and I could go on, it's the same thing that I'm sure a lot of people feel about the Mitch McConnells of the world, the James Inhofs of the world, the people that are hurting progress. Because there are a lot of innovative ideas out there. You know, that to me, I think, is one of the central focuses that you've seen on the left, this primarying of representatives who are basically, they answer to corporate special interests. They don't answer to their constituents. You could say what you want about, you know, we'll leave AOC out of the discussion, but if you look at a lot of the non-corporate representatives that are on the Democratic side, there's not many of them, but they do answer to their constituents. I'm wondering what your thoughts would be if there was an active rise on the political right to not have, to basically push for non-corporate representation and basically fight for the values that you believe in. Because I think if we did see that transpire on the GOP side, we would get to where we need to go a lot faster. Because as far as I can see, that's not really happening right now, but it doesn't mean that it can't.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very much in favor of principles over people or party or politics. You know, there are times when somebody who's, you know, not generally aligned with me says something interesting, and it's like, yeah, you know, that's dead right. And I feel like we need more of that. We need more, you know, you mentioned all these people that you like they're fine as people, but like, I need to go through each of their ideas, and we need to kind of talk through the merits of their ideas. And I think, unfortunately, we have got into this over, you know, this sort of duopoly. Like, talk about, if you want to break up the biggest duopoly that's out there, it's the Republican Democrat, you know, traditional stronghold. I mean, that is the duopoly. I mean, that's the illusion that we have some sort of a choice. and we don't have a lot of a choice. So, you know, if from my standpoint, you know, I'd like to focus more on the principles. And I, again, I feel like the principles to avoid the same problems of when people get into power, what happens with the cronyism and the special interests and the cash grabs and all that stuff. Again, I would contend that a smaller government approach, which again is not a non-government approach, but just a smaller with more free market principles, really accomplishes that. And so I, you know, I'm all for like tearing down the whole current, you know, couple party system that we have. And I think it would be super interesting, he said, if like the progressives and the libertarians, perhaps, and the politically homeless could find, you know, some way. And, you know, again, it's important to listen to constituents, but it's also important to have some reality in terms of perspective of, you know, there are a lot of things that people want that aren't necessarily producing good outcomes, which is why, again, I feel like having the federal government involved in so many things is not sort of the best way to approach that. But again, yeah, I feel like there's some interesting kind of melding that could happen there.
I think that the only way that you're going to be able to really get progressives on board with any idea of free marketplace is that healthcare, education, and corrections need to be taken out of the for-profit sector, because those things are not, those are not things that need to be for profit. There's many other things that are for profit that I think is fine. If somebody invents a widget and wants to rip people off for that widget, have at it, man. Fly around in your corporate jet and have gold fixtures. And yes, I was on a corporate jet with gold fixtures because Stephen Hilbert from Conseco back when I lived in Indianapolis, but I digress. So like, I have no problem with that. And progressives, I don't know. I mean, yes, I've been called a communist by people, but I'm not. I have no problem with capitalism. I just believe that those three areas need not be on our for-profit table. I think there's many other ways for people to make a profit. And especially when we're talking about benefiting small businesses, because right now, all three of those things are not being helping small businesses. They're only helping big corporations when you're talking about the profit. So yeah, if those things are taken off the profit, you know, field, then yeah, I think that there's a lot of things we could agree on.
Well, let me push back on that a little bit. I think the corrections one kind of stands on its own. I mean, the government is there to protect our individual rights. Managing the judicial system is something within that. I don't see a lot of sense in terms of that being sort of a for-profit entity. So that's one that's probably like an easy one to get people to agree with how to shift that. Although there would have to be some element of competition in there, because otherwise you end up with a system like the VA or the DMV or anything else that the government runs. So we'd have to think through, like, how do you make it not, you know, kind of the current crony scenario that's today, but also not a government system either, which is not a good thing. But I don't understand the issue with profits, because there is a inherent driver in terms of the pursuing of profits that is self-regulatory if you have competition. And again, I will contend that the reason why healthcare and education are so messed up is because there's no capitalism, there's no free markets, there's no freedom, choice, or transparency within those. Pursuing a profit or not pursuing a profit is really more about aligning efficiencies. If you think about nonprofit organizations outside of government organizations, just, you know, somebody who's raising money for whatever interest, they're some of the most poorly run organizations that are out there. And what usually ends up happening, because they don't have to answer to customers who are making decisions, again, based on profit margins, they don't have to answer to shareholders, they don't have to worry about it at all, is that they end up wasting so much money on overhead. So they have more bloated salaries, they have ridiculously lavish offices, because they need to spend that money so that they're not showing a profit. And so pursuing profit doesn't make it, it actually makes it more efficient. Having nonprofit often makes it less efficient. So I think that it's not understanding the motives of the profits, and not understanding that some of these things that we're talking about aren't using capitalistic tendencies. and trying to mold it in a fashion that brings freedom, choice, transparency into the process that benefits the outcomes that we all, I'm sure, can agree on.
But what about people that can't afford healthcare or can't afford an education? And, you know, you can make it as competitive as you want, but there's people that are not going to be able to afford that. So when you have a system that's based on profit, it's inherently profitable for there to be people that either don't get healthcare or don't get an education.
Sure. But so that's why I'm talking about like government guardrails. So like in the terms of education, as I said, like let's just take off the table that government doesn't fund at least early education. We could talk about college and that's a whole separate thing, but early education, you know, K through 12, I don't think anybody is saying like, no, we should rip that away from government. But what we are saying is that there should be choice. So if you have a government school and you have a for-profit school and you're the family and we as the government give you dollars and you say, well, you can use it at the government school that's nonprofit, or you can use it at the for-profit school that's incentivized to do that, and you have the free choice to do that, why wouldn't you want to do that? We've seen some of the, you know, these private schools and their fantastic output because, again, they don't have the same kind of issues that come along with the, you know, government central planning mandates and the bloating of the administration. They actually spend more dollars on the students. They have to, because they have to compete for them. So that bringing that element of competition, that freedom, that choice, it doesn't take any dollars away from anyone. It just brings in more competition to the process. And I guarantee you, especially in underprivileged and underserved areas, they would much rather have the choice on where to go than be stuck with some of the crappy schools that they're in.
They would rather the money be in their public school instead of be going to charter schools that are fly by night. I mean, we have a very different situation here in Florida. So I don't know what it is like where you are, but here we have charter schools that open. They have no, they're not accountable to anybody. They make their little profit and they move on their way. And what that does in the meantime is it siphons money out of the public schools that really would, is where that's needed. And so I think that we have to, you know, take into consideration that, you know, some things might not be best with a profit motive.
Yeah. And I also, and if I could piggyback on that, that's one of the reasons why I've been very adamant that, you know, Betsy DeVos was terrible for education in this country in terms of what she was advocating for. And I would say that the one distinct difference that you would have seen if Gillum was governor instead of DeSantis is that Gillum very much was running on the idea of the not allowing the consolidation of power amongst the charter schools, because that's become it's a commodity now. It really is. And the public schools, as I'm sure you're aware, in Florida they're bad. Like they are. And the charter schools, you know, we have one here in Pembroke Pines that you like to talk
about.
But
Pembroke Pines is an anomaly. That's because its charter is with the city and it is extremely very, that school is very well cared for, regulated. The teachers are well paid. Like they really are on their game, but it also, it's not a for-profit thing. They don't have shareholders. So, and that is the only charter school I believe in Broward that has anywhere near the credential. Like it's the best with no.
Let's talk about like Chicago. So I live in a district where we have in the numbers in the book, but I think it's somewhere around $21,000 that we spend on a student. So it's not like there's a lack of money that's going into the schools. It's been increasing at insane rates. The problem is it's all going into administration, buildings, facilities. It's not going into the education of students. And so that's what happens when you have the government doing these mandates and then obviously being in bed with these big unions, is that that's not, there's more money that's pouring in, but there's no accountability because I, as the consumer, don't have a choice. If I'm in this zip code, like that's the school I'm going to, and it's a huge burden to be able
if I could ask, Carol, do you live in Cook County? Is that where you live?
I do live in Cook County.
Okay, so you live in the most democratically controlled county in the United States, the most overly regulated, the most like centralized controlled county in the United States.
And it's horrendous. The outcomes are horrendous here. So the amount of money that we pay for the horrible infrastructure, for the lack of safety, for the poor school outcomes is sort of the bellwether, as you said, for bad outcomes when you have that much power that's concentrated with the government.
We've seen your mayor. So again, we're well aware of just how bad politics is in Chicago, and it is unfortunate because it is a beautiful city and it has a lot to offer. And the
it was
and I had an amazing experience in Springfield. You know, just going to visit the land of Lincoln, and you know, Illinois is a great state, and it is unfortunate that you know, you do have this overly.
I love Chicago.
Yeah.
I lived in Evanston, but I loved.
Well, Chicago. I mean, again, you know, Evanston, Deerfield, that's not Chicago. I'm talking about the city itself.
But I live downtown. So
yeah. And so when you see the imbalance that exists in Chicago and you see how bad the South Side and the Southwest Side in particular are, it doesn't need to be that way, but yet it's been that way for a very long time. And I do think, you know, bringing this conversation full circle and the issue at hand that I think is one of the biggest causes of the problems that we have today, particularly when you look at where the biggest spikes of COVID have been and the whole concept of centralized planning versus decentralized planning. It's not that centralized planning doesn't have its merits, but we are over-centralized in way too many places. And because we are so much at each other's throats politically these days, you're finding so many people, especially those who identify as liberal, for example, they're all flocking to the major cities in this country. And we are becoming so overly populated. It is becoming so unbelievably expensive
to live
there.
There's too many people here.
There are.
There's just too many people
here. And we are literally stuck where we are is right between Fort Lauderdale and Miami. So as you can imagine,
there's just too many people
here. It's overpopulated in the summertime where it's 95 and super humid. So you can imagine what it's like during the holiday season. It's pretty rough down here. And unless we really focus, which I think is the best part of your book, it's the last chapter, guys, just so you know, it's a long one, but it's very important. The difference between centralized planning and decentralized planning. It's one of the reasons why you can go to different parts of the United States, beautiful parts. I happen to be a big fan of North Carolina and Tennessee.
I think I turned you on to that.
I like Tennessee way before I even knew who you were.
There's a North Carolina thing.
But there is something to be said for states that are temperate climate, have a lot to offer, not expensive to live there, and primarily
there's not that many people.
Well, that's true too. And they're decentralized in terms of planning. One of the great things about North Carolina is that it's got a lot of everything. If Asheville's your speed, you go there. If Charlotte's your speed, if Durham's your speed, if even Wilmington is your speed, there's no one city that is so over the top more so than any other.
It's spread out better.
It's very well spread out.
That's true.
And the same thing is true of Tennessee, even though, you know, you've got
Nashville, Memphis.
Nashville and Memphis is primarily, especially Memphis, is where a lot of people end up going. But there's still Knoxville. There's still these places in between that you can go to where it isn't this major city hub where
we're
all
on top
the
same, of each
yeah,
other
where
here.
Everybody's
literally
on top
people
of each other.
Are on top. Literally people. This is when the Surfside condo collapsed. And as horrible as that is, I'm thinking people are not meant to live on top of each other like this.
And this is where the whole concept of decentralization, the main argument of your book, I think is fantastic. I think it is the one that people really need to be focusing on. And I've said it before and I'll say it again, guys, the only way we're going to save ourselves is if progressives and libertarians learn how to do this.
And I don't know why you specified just libertarian.
I do. Because
I have Republican friends.
No, it's true. But I'm talking about the political philosophy.
I do have Republican friends.
I know you do. But what I'm saying is that the whole concept of anti-establishment, anti-cronyism, that is embedded in the mindset of progressivism and libertarianism. Yeah. There are stark differences, to be fair, but there are a lot of similarities too. And that's where the importance of what you're writing about, ironically, the way that I discovered you is how one of the ways that we were able to start building our name recognition. And that was going on Tim Pool's show. You know, by doing that, over 500,000 people saw it.
I think they all called me Karen.
There were a number of guys who did. I'm sure you got it too, Carol. Carol and Karen are not that far from each other anyways.
No, so. Funny enough, nobody ever, I think just because of my personality, nobody sort of goes in that direction.
People who know me would never think I'm that either, but yet the Tim Pool audience was a...
I would just say is keep your mind open to places where you can bring the principles of capitalism. And you know, again, forget about profit versus not profit. Like, I think you guys are too hung up in that, because as I said, economically, there are some good reasons. But think about freedom, choice, and transparency. Like, where are places that we can bring that in, even if the government needs to be involved, and where we can take the government out of being the middleman as well? Because the more things that they have their hand in, the worse it is for all of us. And if I'll say one more thing as well, is that, you know, we're talking about empowering the worker right now, and the reason why is bad, but it is what it is, so I'm going to tell you to capitalize on it anyway, is that we have the most worker-friendly job market of all time. Like, this is historic. You will probably never see an opportunity like this again, where there's 10 million jobs available to be filled. People are quitting their existing jobs. So whether you have a job or you're thinking about going into the workforce, now is the time that, even if you like your current job, go out, explore other ones, get other offers. And again, this is where I'm going to get you guys to become a little bit more capitalist oriented. Try to get equity ownership. Ask for stock options. Ask for equity so you can participate in the growth of the companies that you are.
I demand equity of this company right now.
You can have it all.
Let me have the equity.
So that's what I want everyone to do, because if you can go out, even if you love your current job and you've got another offer, you can take that back and use that as negotiating leverage with your current employer. You have no idea what an insanely great job market it is. So like shoot your shot. Like, now's the time. This may never happen again in history.
I'm going to have to go look for something better.
Take a good look, guys. The War on Small Business by Carol Roth. And she is definitely on our side in many ways. Remember,
don't be haters.
Any place but Amazon.
Don't be haters.
Bookshop.org. You can filter a local small business.
Yeah. Go pick it up. It is a very fun read. She goes easy on Bernie. She has some shots at him, but I think she went easy.
You guys can suck it up.
I'm not going to say. You're going to learn. You want to learn something from the perspective of where about 80% of the landmass in the country is covered, in the mindset that people think when it comes to how economics work in the United States. Learn more about the rest of the country.
They can't handle it.
It is very important. Well,
they can't handle it.
The one thing I will say, Carol, on your behalf, I do believe in capitalism. I believe in a hybrid system, but the idea that you're bringing socialism to the United States and that's going to be our economic system, it's not happening. That doesn't mean that the system can't be modified and it can't get better, because the free market is what defines the United States. But let's make it better. Let's make it so that it does work for everybody. Carol, do you have a YouTube channel or anything that you want to plug? You?
So the best place to find me, and I have a slightly warped sense of humor, so like, just be forewarned, I'm on Twitter at Carol J.S. Roth, and that's where I spend most of my time. And I generally like being helpful as well. So if you have a thought, or if I can help provide you with a connection, or just like throw out an idea, you can go to carolroth.com and there's a contact form there. Feel free to send me an email anytime and just say, hey, I was thinking about this idea, or I was, you know, thinking about this job or this investment or whatever. And I'm always happy to spare some words for people and try and help, because here at the end of the day, I want people to succeed. Like, this is where we're at. Like, I believe in everyone. I believe everyone has the opportunity to be incredibly successful. And I am a product of that American dream. You know, my dad was an electrician. He would never believe where I am today and where my husband is today. And I want to preserve that opportunity. And like you said, make it better, make it more accessible to everybody. So,
well, Blue Bandit, a good friend of the show, definitely make sure you pick up a copy of her book. Carol is a fantastic guest. And I think we should definitely have you on again. And I think the next time we should do like an economic panel of some kind. I think that would definitely be a way to further this conversation.
It'll be like a whole room of the teacher on Charlie Brown.
I'll
be like,
yeah, absolutely.
No, it's great. And I would say to you too, like, if you guys have ideas or things that you want to banter around or connections, like, I think this is super productive, and we should just figure out how we can take what we have here and harness it and like take back the insanity that's going on around the discussions in our country. So I love the fact that we're able to have this discussion.
I'm going to give you a little treat just before you go off the air. I think you're going to appreciate this.
Oh no. Wait, who are we getting?
Carol, I just want to let you know that I've read your book. I've got it right here. Here's the book. It's a really, really important. Well, I can totally read. And I listen well, you know, I really listen. And I read this book. It's really great. It's almost as good as The Art of the Deal. Not quite as good. Let's be fair. But it's a really incredible book. I recommend you buy it. Go out there. Carol's definitely doing a great job. Tremendous job. Incredible job. Nice to see you.
Bravo. All you didn't do is drop the word Gina for China. That's the only thing China. That would have just like taken it to the next level, but like 10
we
out of 10.
Did a game. We did a game during the debate between him and Joe Biden with our producers. And every time Joe said, come on, every time Joe said, come on. And every time Trump said China, I had to smoke a bowl, but like we had this whole thing going here with that. And let me tell you, he said China quite a bit.
he liked to say China. Anyway, thank you guys so much
Thank you, Carol. We look forward to seeing you again sometime. And guys, get the book. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye. I mean, it's a lot of fun. You know, again, these conversations are really not that hard to have. I mean, again, we're not inviting Ben Shapiro. We're not going on Ben Shapiro's show.
Oh, good God.
You know, we're not talking good God, not that. Like that, you know?
Don't freak me out.
But it is very important that these conversations are had because we are getting somewhere. I really do think that there is a desire to try to find common ground.
Yeah.
And I think we definitely did find it. We don't agree with her on, you know, I think... It's funny how I specifically emphasized with Medicare for All in particular that it's government funded, not government run. And yet she still wanted to circle back to it's government run. But no, that's not what we want.
To her, I think the whole concept of government having any say so whatsoever in pricing.
That's a libertarian mindset. That's a libertarian.
Yeah.
Mindset.
And I, you and know, that's
a,
again.
But again, that doesn't, you know what? I look at it as a negotiation. All right. So you disagree with this. Let's find common ground over here. This will be where we ultimately end up agreeing. And if you agree that we need to do this for your side, how about give us this on this?
Just the whole idea of the commodification of healthcare and education makes me like incensed. Yeah, but that's
incorrect.
Another story.
It's incorrect.
And the other problem is, and I didn't say this to her. Well, you know, when she first started and the first words were like, make healthcare affordable for everyone. And I'm thinking, yeah, no, the way you do that is you just give them the healthcare. See, the affordability factor isn't a factor if you just give them the health care.
You know what? You know what? We had a great conversation.
Yeah.
She definitely understands where we're coming from. We're not trying to attack her. We're not trying to tell her she's wrong. It's one of those. You will eventually convert people who will understand that the best free market option you have when it comes to healthcare is a single payer universal system. If you want to have a supplemental market for stuff that isn't part of the basics that you need, then that's fine. I don't think anybody would have a problem with that as long as it isn't something that's required. If it isn't something that's required, then there really shouldn't be a problem there. And that's where you ultimately get that common ground. And I do think that she was right in a number of areas. And again, when it comes to union power,
she got into something. Smell that.
Yeah, you got into something.
What the hell is that?
I don't know, Lou. What have you been up to? Lou's ever in trouble.
Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.